Welcome to Rohatsu Session. It's totally awesome that you all have managed to arrange your lives to be here right now. Whether it's for one period, whether it's for one day, whether it's for several days, whether it's for whole 7 days of sesshin, here we are. It's not easy to arrange a life to make space for sitting together in silence like this to celebrate Buddha's great awakening. I especially always love to sit Rohatsu Sesshin because I think it's the one sesshin of the year where all over the Zen world people are sitting sesshin at the same time. Maybe some others also have a Buddha's birthday sesshin and a Parinirvana sesshin, but not everybody. But almost every Zen group in this entire world system does some kind of Rohatsu Sesshin. The three centers of San Francisco Zen Center in the city and Green Gulch Farm and Tassajara are all doing a 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin right now. Maybe not exactly the same days, but overlapping with us. Jikoji is doing a 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin. I don't know about Kanando, probably. And even Monterey Zen Center is doing a day of sitting during this week. And of course, everywhere in Japan, Soto and Rinzai and Obaku Zen, everybody sits the first week of December to celebrate Buddha's awakening. So we can open to the support of many, many people devoted to Zazen this week. Traditionally, maybe because of this, Buddha's enlightenment, Rohatsu Sesshin is sometimes like the big one. We honor that here by treating it for some years now as the only 7-day Sesshin that we do. At the temple I practiced in Japan, we had 7-day Sesshin almost every month, but Rohatsu was kind of special. We started it like an hour earlier and sat an hour later every day. Which I think was 3 o'clock to 10 o'clock. And simplified it even more. Services, chanting got even shorter. Zazen got even longer. So, Rohatsu Sesshin. Because we're celebrating Buddha's awakening, I thought that might be a nice topic to explore this week in this talking time. What is Buddha's awakening? What's the big deal? Many, many stories could be told, some overlapping, some completely contradictory, about this issue of Buddha's awakening or enlightenment. So, during this week, I thought it would be nice to tell some stories from the Buddha himself about his awakening. There's many, many stories, which also strikes me as kind of amazing that we're talking about 500 BC, and this was an oral transmission that wasn't written down, but passed along through memorization and orally from teacher to student for at least a couple centuries until it started getting written down. But there's so much detail. The Buddha, in these scriptures, described quite a bit about his own awakening. And then there are later Mahayana sutras that embellish the tale even more. But I thought this week we could look at the old story, the so-called original story, the early tradition in the Buddha's words from the Pali canon, the foundational vehicle, the early teachings. If there's any story of Buddha's awakening that everyone would agree on in the Dharma world, and it's the closest we can get, it would be this story. The events leading up to that renowned night under the Bodhi tree, and then the description, the kind of internal description of what was going on in the Buddha's body and mind at that time. He recounts in some detail. And then we can look at Dogen's understanding in our lineage, Zen tradition. Dogen has an essay called Great Awakening, Great Enlightenment, where he takes up this topic specifically and exhausts it. And they're quite different sounding, which is why I thought it might be nice to look at both. The old school Buddha's words and then Dogen's words about this issue of Buddha's great awakening. I like to say awakening as opposed to enlightenment. Googling around a little bit about where did this word enlightenment come from, seems to be that it was coined by one Max Müller in the 1800s. Max Müller was a German scholar of Indian religion, both Buddhism and Hinduism, and translated a whole bunch from Sanskrit into English, maybe German too. He moved to England and lived there. And I have, early on in practice, I actually looked at his books, particularly the Pali Canon. He was the first to translate a lot of these early sutras. And I think hard and important task to be a translator and try to convey the sense of these words. So Buddha used this word Bodhi, which is closely related to Buddha. And it's closely related to the English word bud, which is like the kind of the just opening of a flower, the way that a flower begins to open is a bud. So in Sanskrit and Pali, it's usually translated as awakening. I think awakening is actually quite a literal translation of Bodhi. And, but old Max Müller decided to translate it as enlightenment. And people say that he was also influenced by Western philosophy, and he was it's not coincidence that he translated Bodhi as this word that also refers to this 17th century movement in Europe called the Enlightenment, which was like a not exactly philosophical movement. How would you say it? It's like it was a cultural shift maybe in Europe at that time called the Enlightenment, like the age of reason. That's one maybe way to sum it up, as I understand it. It was like this time in Europe where people were questioning a lot of superstitions and really looking to science and philosophy and logic and reason. It was the age of let's actually question things and not just assume some old story is true. The age of reason. And Max Müller really liked this idea, and he thought that Buddhism was very much in accord with this age of reason. It was, even in terms of other Indian traditions, Buddha was questioning a lot of the tradition in his time too, and trying to confirm how things are in his own direct experience. So there's some virtues to this word enlightenment, but it's a little bit random, and I think it was sort of Max Müller's, maybe, he had a little agenda even in translating Bodhi as enlightenment. And also, he was translating these other Indian texts, non-Buddhist texts, so like moksha, which means, I think, more quite literally, liberation, very important term, liberation from suffering and bondage, liberation from the cycle of birth and death, was important in pre-Buddhism, too. He also translates moksha as enlightenment. So he kind of mixing all these traditions with different nuances of different terms and throwing them into this lump of called enlightenment. Yeah. Awakening, enlightenment, Bodhi. Let's begin the story of Buddha's quest for enlightenment. It caught on, right? It stuck. I really like Bhikkhu Bodhi, the translator. And, but it's so common now in English that we just use it sometimes. Good old Max Müller. The sutra is called the Noble Search. Buddha was on a noble quest. This is told after his awakening. Buddha says, monks, before my enlightenment, before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow and defilement. So they talked sometimes in 500 BC. Oh, it's quite beautiful too. And isn't this the case that we are subject to birth, old age, sickness and death, and we often things that we seek in this life are also subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. We seek impermanent, temporary, conditioned phenomena. We seek impermanent experiences of happiness. It's natural we do this with these experiences. We we could understand as subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. We just seek some comfort and solace. We like a good vacation. But these vacations are subject to birth. They start on a certain day. They're subject to aging because in a week-long vacation, halfway through, it's already getting kind of old. And then at the end of the vacation, when we drive home, it dies, that vacation. So before my awakening, I, who am subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, I sought, or was also subject to aging, birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. But then I considered thus, well, maybe still as this Buddha living with his father and mother in a palace, or large home, he considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is also subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn, supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, Nibbana is Pali for the Sanskrit term, Nirvana. That was like a new kind of thought, a consideration of this Bodhisattva. I'm subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, and everything that I'm looking for in this life is also subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. Suppose, understanding the danger in what is subject to birth, I, instead of seeking something else is born, I seek the unborn, the supreme security, refuge from bondage, nirvana, the unborn, the unconditioned. Suppose that being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nirvana. Suppose I continue seeking, but start seeking for something that's not a thing. The unborn, the unaging, the unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, supreme security from bondage, entrapment, nirvana. Nirvana means like cessation, or it's like when a fire burns itself out. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So it's the beginning of the noble search, the Buddha's leaving home. We still imitate the Buddha's practice like this, sometimes we shave off the hair and beard. Ochre is a translation for the Pali Sanskrit word kashaya, that we, in Japanese, say kesa is the name of this, these robes. And rakasus are also a kind of okesa, even if they're not ochre colored necessarily. In the prime of life, the Buddha, age 29, we hear the Buddha thought, I gotta get serious about this. So that's the beginning of his quest. And before we move on to Dogen, I think a nice model of the Buddha's awakening. This story will continue to unfold over the week, and the kind of events leading up to the Buddha sitting under that tree, and then what exactly happened under the tree according to his kind of detailed description. But another really nice model that the Buddha later presented, he doesn't say that he himself went through these particular 10, it's not exactly 10 stages, it's kind of four stages of awakening. He presents this classic model of really important in Theravada Buddhism. And the Buddha taught it quite a bit, but in his own description he doesn't talk about these four stages, and I think the common understanding is for the Buddha, he was kind of unique. He was trying all this other stuff that wasn't quite working, and then this one night he kind of went through the whole program in this one zazen period. But then he found that when he was talking to his students, that was too much to just lay it out so suddenly. So he taught a sort of gradual four stages. And I think it's a really beautiful model, because it's practical. And even in the early sutras, the Buddha is teaching his own students, and they start to have these aha moments. They kind of get it, and they kind of get it in these four stages. So I think the Buddha's really actually looking at how he's able to present his own understanding and how people are going to, people seem to get it a little bit gradually. So this model is, again, I've long appreciated this, and it's maybe, I don't know if we've ever talked about it here. It's a model, these four stages might seem like one is acquiring something more in each stage, some deeper kind of level of enlightenment or awakening. It might sound that way when we talk about four stages of progression to awakening, but it's actually more like the opposite. It's these four stages are defined in terms of sometimes called fetters, 10 hindrances that are dropped away one at a time. So that as the stages progress, it's like we're removing more and more rather than gaining more and more. I think it's a nice way to talk about it. So we think we're gonna get and accumulate more and more knowledge or something. It's more the other way, where we already have too much. Too much too many fetters or too many hindrances. And we're letting them go. Through insight, through seeing them, we're letting them go. One by one, gradually. And they kind of come in sets. So the first stage of awakening is called a stream entry in this early model. The stream enterer. And it's kind of an awakening. It's even presented in the teachings. It's not just like beginning to practice, as it might sound, like entering the stream of practice. I think it's really, Buddha sometimes says, the stream of nirvana, or the stream that leads toward awakening. Of course there's beginning practice, but then this is particularly a kind of direct insight. And the way that stream entry is defined is that these three kind of hindrances are no longer there. These three hindrances drop away. And I think it's understood that as these fetters or hindrances drop away, they drop away and don't come back. Which will be an interesting thing to keep in mind as we look at Dogen, because Dogen plays a lot in his Great Awakening essay about awakening returning to delusion in the Zen tradition. But this early tradition, demonstrates that these are really kind of profound awakenings, because it's not just like one sort of gets the idea, it's one sees this hindrance, that hindrance drops away and it never returns. So the first three for the stream enter that are dropped away, the most important first one, which is really the beginning of the thread that runs through all of them up to awakening, is the view of the separate self. That's a hindrance, a fetter. Sakkaya ditti in Pali. Satkaya drishti in Sanskrit. It's the view or understanding. We talked about this a lot this fall in the Sunday class. It was kind of about this topic. The separate self would be the feeling and thinking and believing that there's some experiencer in addition to this flow of experiences of body and mind. There's a conditioned flow of body and mind experiences. We could call the conventional self. That one doesn't need to drop away. But feeling and thinking that there's some entity in addition to this flow of experience, some experiencer, that would be like a separate self, one way of talking about it. That one is not only understood conceptually, but really come to be seen. It's like there really isn't one. And even when I get triggered by somebody insulting me, that can still happen for a stream enterer. But the stream enterer, when they see that that's happening, if they kind of, they catch that habit, and they say, this really doesn't make any sense anymore. It's like, it's an old habit based on an illusion. There's not somebody actually here to be insulted and triggered in addition to just the flow of experiences. But they still do get triggered. That's why it's just the first stage here. So that particular hindrance called samyojana in Sanskrit drops away. And the next one is doubt. And we're talking about a particular doubt. Doubt in that is so. Doubt that there is no separate self. And doubt about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Doubt that the Buddha really was completely awakened and gone beyond greed, hate, and delusion. That such awakening is possible. It's not just an old fable from ancient India. So all those kind of doubts of it's too exaggerated a story. You can't really end greed, hate, and delusion. You know, that doubt in these early teachings has to be dropped away. No, I'm still subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, but I see, really because I see that there's no separate self here, no experiencer. I see based on that principle, if I were to integrate that truth, that confirmation of reality into my entire experience, this really could be like the end of greed, hate, and delusion. I haven't realized it, but I know it's possible. And it, all the sutras now start to become like, this is like our roadmap. This is like all possible for a human being. And people have done it, like the Buddha. So that any doubts about that are dropped away. And then the third, interestingly, is it sounds a little bit minor, but it's one of the three for stream entry, is grasping at kind of like ethics and spiritual practices as the cause of awakening. I think it's so interesting because the Buddha was so into ethical conduct and the precepts, right? And so into practices. He was giving all these practices, practices to purify body and mind and so on. But that any kind of conditioned practice or any like method or any even the precepts are, we do practice them and the Buddha teaches them over and over, but these are not the source of liberation. Interestingly, that's what the fetter is, to think that if I just practice perfect conduct and just practice these methods perfectly, that will be the cause of awakening. But it's like, no, it's kind of like it's an understanding, and these practices help the understanding, and you really do actually need to do them, but they're not really the cause of the awakening. Sila Rata Paramarsha in Sanskrit. Sila is like precepts or morality or ethics. To cling to that as the cause of awakening is a hindrance. I think it strikes me as unusual that the Buddha taught that, as being so into Sila and teaching Sila so much. So I just, of course we practice them, but to grasp them and feel like, if I just perfect my conduct, that will be awakening. No, that's not quite it. That's the stream enter, releases these three fetters, and they never arise again. But they still can get into greed, hate, and some other kinds of delusions. Why? Because there's ancient habits from infinite lifetimes of kind of acting as if we're a separate self based on the belief in separate self. So once one sees through that belief, one can still act on the old habit of believing it. I think a really ingenious insight of the Buddha, that he noticed that there's a lot of work to do still after this insight. You could say it's like applying the insight over and over again to all our old habits. So in the second stage of awakening, called the once returner, which means all this stages are kind of framed in this framework of ending the cycle of rebirth. So once returner means there's enough karmic residue that you're going to be born once more still, but that's not very much in samsara left, but it's going to take another lifetime to complete the task. It's once returner, and the once returner is defined, interestingly, it's the one of these four stages, it's not actually dropping away of fetters, it's just greatly weakening these hindrances of sense craving and aversion or ill will or anger. And I think it's just emphasizing that this craving for pleasure and aversion from pain are so deep and so strong that they get two stages to work on them. They get the once returner that can't quite eliminate them. They're so strong. But it weakens them by, again, how does it weaken them? By just remembering, who is all this pleasure and pain happening to? It's just this causal series. There's nobody, not really an experiencer that they're happening to. That makes it much easier to deal with pain and pleasure if it's not happening to an experiencer. But if it's just arising and ceasing experiences of pleasure and pain, much easier to start to work with it. Then the non-returner is the third stage. The non-returner means you don't have to come back and keep working on this in another lifetime. You can finish it off in this lifetime. The non-returner eliminates permanently these hindrances of sense craving. I want some, I need some pleasure for me. Me, the separate self, is really what it's based on. And I really can't stand that person or this event or basically this experience, this ill will or anger, aversion towards some experience. I don't want it to be happening to me, the separate self. So maybe it takes a long time, I think. One can have this stream enter thing. I talked to various people in the Theravada tradition. I remember when I was in Thailand practicing in the Theravada monastery for a little bit, I talked to, these were like Western monks, and I was, you know, so you gave up a lot to be here. You can't even have anything. You just get one meal a day. You have nothing in your life except meditation. And like, what's your goal here? What are you doing this for? And I remember one young man was like, my goal is stream enter in this lifetime. It's like, the other, you know, the arhat thing is too much. But if I could realize stream entry, which is a very humble thing to say, right? Somebody, we might say, they're already, must be pretty awakened to be even able to live that way. Like, no, I still feel like there's this separate self here. But in this lifetime, I want to really cut through not just the conceptual view, but the feeling that there's such a one. It's beautiful to hear that. Also, it's said in that tradition that all these stages are kind of irreversible. So once you reach stream entry, and you have a big start in your next lifetime. In fact, the Buddha even says in these early sutras, 7 more lifetimes maximum in samsara. How did it come with 7? I have no idea. It's a lucky number. It's more than 1, because 1 would be a once returner, which would mean that you would have to have really worked a lot with craving and aversion. But even if you haven't worked that much with it, this insight, this change of perceiving yourself in the world, will never be lost in your continuum of consciousness from life to life. So you can't just, it's kind of funny that it's irreversible. You could say your next life, you could say, I don't care about that anymore, but it's too late. Your consciousness has been altered permanently. So the third stage of awakening is this non-returner, where the sense craving for pleasurable experiences and the aversion to unpleasant experiences is eliminated. You might think, well, isn't that the end? What more freedom could there be than that? Well, there's one more final stage called the arhat, the fourth stage. Arhat means like a worthy one, worthy of receiving alms as a beggar. That one, actually, there's 5 more hindrances to remove. So far we've covered five, right? It's the view of the separate self, any doubt about the Buddha's teaching, or especially that teaching, and the Four Noble Truths, and his grasping at, or kind of holding, you know, precepts and practices as the cause of liberation, and then have sense craving and ill will. Those are five that are now gone. And then the Arhat has five more. So they're quite subtle at this point. Quite subtle. But the Arhat then eliminates. So we were talking about the non-returner eliminated craving in the desire realm, sense, the five senses, you know, would crave for particular sights, sounds, smells, tastes, sensations. That's in our physical realm. It's a kind of craving. That one's gone, but there's these more subtle realms called the form realm and the formless realm. So the craving to abide in the form realm, where there's no more senses, there's no more physical senses. It's like a meditational realm. In Buddhist cosmology, the so-called heaven realms, the deva realms, are these ones. There's birth in deva realms, where there's no more physical body and so on, but they're kind of blissing out. But they're temporary samsaric realms. Buddha was into some subtlety here. And they go on for like millions of human years, kind of blissing out in these bodiless light realms. But the Buddha's like, we have to go beyond this. We don't want to get stuck there. So craving for kind of being in the form realm has to drop away for an Arhat. Like, they have to like not have some subtle desire to kind of camp out in the kind of conditioned bliss realms for millions of years. They have to get over that. And once they get over that, then they can kind of be born in these formless realms that are even more refined, kind of heaven realms. And no craving there. These are not sense cravings. These are like craving for existence or abidance in these highly refined spiritual realms that are still conditioned. That, in other words, they're impermanent. Man, think about this stuff. I'm like, Buddha was like kind of an intense guy. So those two are like gone. Then pride or conceit. And here we're not talking about usually like human pride, like, cool, I'm an Arhat now. I think it's like much more subtle than that. That they're already over that one. They're like exploring these formless realms. And I think this kind of pride, it's said in the commentaries that it's like a little bit of residue from being an experiencer still, we might say. A little bit of sense of somebody, or some comparison, usually they say, that like, I still compare this stream of being to other streams of beings, good or bad or even the same. So some sort of very subtle pride. And restlessness is another one, very subtle restlessness. Of just like, I'm camping out in the formless heavenly realms, but there's a little bit of like, maybe just a little subtlest agitation of like, I wonder how many millions of years this is going to last, or how many million it's been so far, I haven't been keeping track. And a little bit of this, like, such a thought might be a slightly restless thought. And finally, ignorance. Avidya, any last traces of any delusions about conditionality or unconditionality. and the outflows of sense craving, the outflow of any views of this or that, any extreme views, any kind of becoming, coming to be in any realm, and any kind of ignorance are these outflows, and those have all been like dropped away, and nirvana is realized. So that's the early model of awakening in four stages in the foundational teachings. Luckily for us, Dogen has a much simpler presentation. So just very briefly, just to begin, Dogen's essay called Great Awakening. Great, and it's translated by various translators. So many people translated this. I think people felt like this is something important Dogen has to say. You know, the usual Nishijima translated and Nishiyama translated, but also like Francis Cook translated and Thomas Cleary translated and Kaz Tanahashi translated and Shohaku Okamura translated and maybe others, but there's at least six in English. Yes, Carl Bielefeld. In fact, that's the one I have here. There you go, seven, yeah. So I think it's considered an important essay of Dogen. And before I came here, when living at Greengulch Farm, I remember teaching a class series on this essay once. So I dug up the old notes from this essay called Shogo Genzo Daigo. Go means awakening or enlightenment, and that Chinese character is in its Sino-Japanese pronunciation is go, and it's kind of a it's Japanese like pronunciation. We have on and kun readings in Japanese of characters. There's two ways to read each character, and the kind of local sort of Japanese way of reading it is satori, which is that is much more known term than go. Yeah. Satori is almost might even be in the English dictionary. I think D.T. Suzuki and others popularized it as a Japanese way of talking about enlightenment. In fact, no, it wasn't Max Müller, but I think based on Max Müller, and living around the same time, a little bit later, D.T. Suzuki translated this character, Go, or Satori, as enlightenment. So that's why how it got into the Zen world. Enlightenment got into the Zen world through D.T. Suzuki. Go, or Satori, really just, it's not a Buddhist term in particular. It just means to understand, or to perceive, or to realize. That's what satori means. It's just, go, yeah, daigo, great satori is the name of this essay. Great awakening, great perceiving, great understanding. These translators call it, Kaz Tanahashi says great enlightenment. Carl Bielefeld says great awakening. Shohaku Okamura says, great realization. Awakening, realization, enlightenment. Thomas Cleary says, understanding, great understanding. These are all, I think, valid translations for satori. So Dogen used this word, satori. Go is the other pronunciation. And the other words he used are for awakening are kaku, which interestingly also in the Japanese reading, the other Japanese reading besides kaku is satori. It's a different character. And kaku actually means, it also means to realize, perceive, understand, but also kind of literally means awakening, awaken or awakening. I'm not sure if they use it for like awakening from sleep, maybe, but it has a particular connotation of awakening, and it also is used for bodhi, which means awakening. So Dogen uses kaku, quite a bit. He uses Satori and Go quite a bit. But Dogen really most of all likes this term Sho, which means like verification or confirmation, as in practice, and we say practice and realization are not two. That's this term, Shu and Sho. Shu Sho Ichi Nyo. Practice and realization are one suchness, literally. But what we translate as realization literally means, the Sho literally means like confirmation or verification. And Dogen really likes that one for awakening. So it's, which is interesting that instead of talking about it as awakening, it's more like verifying or confirming something that's already the case. I think that's why he likes it. It has potential for a non-dual understanding. So Dogen begins this essay. The great way of the Buddhas is handed down intimately. The meritorious deeds of the ancestors are manifested openly. Therefore, realizing or manifesting great awakening, so it's manifesting is genjo, actualizing or manifesting great satori, arriving at the way beyond awakening, observing awakening and playing with awakening, losing awakening and letting it go. These are everyday matters of the Buddhas and ancestors. Awakening here is, throughout this essay, will be this go or satori. These are all the everyday activity, kajo, of Buddhas and ancestors. Dogen says, the everyday activity of Buddhas and ancestors is drinking tea and eating rice. So that's the kind of thing that realizing great awakening, arriving at the way beyond awakening, observing awakening, playing with awakening, losing awakening and letting it go. These are everyday activities of the Buddhas and ancestors, like having tea and rice. These ancestors, use the 24 hours that they take up. They are used by the 24 hours that they throw away, which is a reference to Jiaozhou. When asked by a monk, how do you use the 24 hours in practice? And Jiaozhou said, you're used by the 24 hours, but I use the 24 hours. But here Dogen says both of them are aspects of this awakening. Taking up this awakening is like using the 24 hours. Throwing it away is like being used by the 24 hours. We don't mind being used or using the 24 hours. We can receive the self and use the self and be used by the self and be received by the self. Going further, these ancestors are playing with the mud ball, playing with the spirit, which are Zen phrases for like playing with the body and playing with the mind, which leap beyond this pivot from great awakening. The Buddhas and ancestors always complete the study that manifests such, in such a way. However, it's not the case that the full awakening of great awakening makes them the Buddhas and ancestors, nor is it the case that the full Buddhas and ancestors of the Buddhas and ancestors makes full great awakening. The Buddhas and ancestors spring off from the boundaries of great awakening. Great awakening is the face that springs beyond the Buddhas and ancestors. It's a little different style than Shakyamuni Buddha talked. Where are all those four stages and all those fetters to drop away? I like those old models, but I also like how Zen takes up and tosses away models. May we sit in present ease throughout this day, being kind to our appearances of separate self, being kind to our body and mind experiences, being kind to all the thoughts and feelings that may arise, letting them be, letting them arise, letting them be, letting them cease, and in such a way we might enjoy the passage of time. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.